politically independent. He was a close personal friend of mine and continues to be to this very day. But insofar as his politics was concerned, he was essentially a businessman and spent most of his time and his talents in the field of business enterprise. He did, however, believe that that good candidates deserve some help and assistance. He also was a strong believer in the two-party system. Like many other businessmen, he contributed to both parties. And in Minnesota, he contributed to some Republican candidates as well as to Democrats. But I think it's fair to say that most of his assistance went to Democrats, to our candidates for governor, to the candidates for the Congress. However, in the 3rd Congressional District of Minnesota, he generally contributed to the Republican candidate. This was primarily because they were social friends. At that time, it was Clark McGregor, who was the Republican congressman from the 3rd Congressional District. And a little bit later, it was William Frenzel. These two men have the help of Dwayne Andreas. But he made it very clear to them and to all others that he was essentially a Humphrey man and that he wanted to confine most of his political attention and what time he had to me. In 1964, he was of invaluable help in my election for vice president. He helped manage the financing of that campaign and brought me in contact with a number of the business people that he knew, people that would ask nothing, but could be of considerable help. He was also very active in supporting President Johnson, being a member of the so-called President's Club, a financial group that backed the Johnson candidacy in 1964, and continued to help the Democratic National Committee during the Johnson years in the presidency. By the way, the president's committee was headed by Arthur Krim of New York. Arthur Krim was a very personal friend. Arthur and his wife Arthur and Matilda Krim were very personal friends of the Johnsons, and Arthur gave a great deal of his time and energy and talent to managing the affairs of the President's Club. This club consisted of those who were donors up to $1,000 or more, and the donations went to the campaign of President Johnson in 1964 and to helping the Democratic National Committee in the years that Johnson was in the White House. In the President's Club, I often spoke to the President's Club, and as did other members of the President's Cabinet. I had the opportunity of meeting many of the business leaders who were willing to associate with the President's Club, but not directly with the Democratic National Committee. Many of the leading business executives of our country readily participated in the President's Club, not because they were Democrats, but because they thought that the Johnson administration was treating them well, and also because, like many other people, they'd like to be known to the president as a friend. Now, Dwayne Andreas was a big contributor to the President's Club, just as he was to the Democratic National Committee and to my campaign for vice president and president. Andreas is a man of considerable wealth, and he has a number of friends who are likewise very successful in business. He did not hesitate to ask these business associates and friends of his to contribute and to contribute generously. But contrary to what is the commonly held opinion, These people were never promised anything, nor was there anything that you could really deliver to them. Most of them made their contributions out of personal friendship and loyalties, not out of partisan commitment, or in the hopes of getting anything from the government. The most that they would have expected from the government is to be treated fairly and not to be harassed. Even then, some of them found the policies of the Johnson administration contrary to their interests, because the Johnson administration was consumer-oriented to a large degree. And also the Johnson administration had a good working relationship with organized labor. And it goes without saying that sometimes the wishes and the objectives of organized labor were not always identical with those of the corporation executives or the large corporate and business leaders of our country. Duane Andreas was a broad-gauged man in terms of his views. He was deeply concerned about American foreign policy, having a strong feeling that there ought to be every effort made to have some kind of understanding with the Soviet Union. He was an original detente man. He surely understood the nature of the Soviet system, but he also believed that trade and commerce in matters that were not of strategic importance was a fundamental and basic part of a successful foreign policy. Therefore, Duane Andreas was always interested in expanded world trade. He was opposed to protectionism, tariffs and quotas, and was as close to being a free trade man as I've ever met. He understood some of my concerns as a representative, as a senator from Minnesota. He knew that my feelings about the importation of certain products that was hurting the American, that was hurting the American farm producer. Even though he opposed those quotas, he seemed to understand why I supported them. During my time as vice president, I helped work out the voluntary agreement between the United States steel industry and the steel industry of Japan. During those days of the mid-60s, the Japanese were shipping in large quantities of steel into the American market, and the American steel industry was suffering from this kind of competition. Likewise, the steel workers were losing their jobs. The steel workers came to me, as did the representatives of industry, or came to President Johnson, as did the representatives of the steel industry, and asked for quotas. They were told that we could not seek legislation that would impose quotas. But the president assigned me to work with our steel industry, both management and labor, and to try to work out something with the Japanese exporters where we could share the market, the growth of the market. In other words, where the Japanese steel industry would have a self-imposed restriction upon the export of steel into the American market at a point where such exports were depressing the steel industry and taking American steel workers' jobs. The United Steelworkers of America were very pleased with this agreement, and it was one of my first efforts at international negotiation. And I'm happy to say that it was a successful one, and even to this day is an operative program that seems to meet the needs of both the Japanese and ourselves. Here again, however, Andreas was a free trade man, believing that trade ought to be expanded and that there should be no artificial impediments. Nevertheless, he was realistic, and he never tried to bring pressure to bear upon me to change my point of view. He did bring to me, however, a new perspective upon the nature of American business enterprise. And I had the opportunity through him to meet a large number, many prominent business and financial leaders. So this man has played a significant role in my public life. He has been generous, understanding, tolerant. He has been a counselor and an advisor, and he has been a patient and persevering friend, never asking for anything, always willing to do more than his share. And many times I called upon him to help others, which he would readily do, simply because I asked him to do so. It's men like Duane Andreas that make it possible for some of us to be in public life, because surely politics is a profession where no one succeeds by himself. It is the one occupation that requires the help of others if you are to be a success. You can lose all by yourself, and you can lose easily and miserably, but you can never win by yourself. It requires others who are willing to back you and support you, who are willing to counsel you and be with you, who are willing to help you in good times and bad times. It's this kind of loyalty that makes possible makes possible public life and political life for most of the men and women who are in politics today. This needs to be understood in the American system. Sure, all of us who are in public life have prejudices or commitments or points of view. I suppose none of us are totally objective because we are the creatures of our environment and our association, as well as our own personal and political philosophy. But I have found that many people are willing to help you who do not always agree with your point of view or your politics, but they may find in you someone that they can trust, someone that they believe is good someone that they believe is good for the community or the state or the nation. There are people of that breadth of vision and and of such unselfish nature. And thank God that we have them. Paragraph. I think it is very important for any man or woman that occupies a position of public trust, particularly an office of a state or national dimension, to have a broad and intimate understanding and knowledge of the constituency that they seek to serve. Even though you may have the support of the labor movement, as I've been privileged to have throughout my public career, and even though you may be classified in the political spectrum as a progressive or a liberal, it is important that you also understand the concerns and the feelings, yes, the prejudices and the points of view of others, of the other side of others in the political spectrum. This is why I have tried, all during my public life, I've tried to broaden my association. I have never forgotten those who helped me, and I find myself very comfortable with many of the policies and programs that are supported and encouraged by organized labor, by the National Farmers Union, yes, by the League of Women Voters, by other citizen-oriented organizations. And frequently I've found myself in opposition to the official policy line of such great organizations as the American Medical Association, the United States Chamber of Commerce, and the National Association of Manufacturers, just to mention some. However, I have never believed that one should be dogmatic or doctrinaire on these matters. Rather, you should seek to try to understand and to work and to listen to the other point of view. One organization with which I've had a splendid relationship over the years is the United States Junior Chamber of Commerce, commonly known as the JCs. This group of young business and professional men has exhibited remarkable community leadership and deep concern about our nation. It has taken an active role, for example, in sponsoring programs that assist the mentally retarded. It has worked on voter registration and the 18-year-old vote. It has done much to activate young business and professional people to take a keener interest in public affairs. It's been my privilege to address several of these JC conventions, and I always found the young men in attendance at these conferences alert, active, and exceedingly and deeply involved in matters that relate to their community and nation. Again, these contacts are so valuable for any man or woman, for any person who has any position, any key position of political leadership. But those contacts must go far beyond what are known as the established organizations of management, business, and labor. They must go into the educational community and into agriculture, like the National Farmers Organization, the American Farm Bureau Federation, the National Farmers Union, and the Grange Society. All of these organizations have much to contribute to one's thinking and understanding of the problems that confront our country, and particularly the agricultural sector. And then there are the special trade organizations that are surely important to know and with which to keep in contact. But over and beyond these are the groups such as the Anti-Defamation League of the respected Jewish fraternal organization known as B'nai B'rith. There is the Civil Rights Leadership Conference that brought together the organizations of black people and the different religious groups of our country. There are the veterans organizations, the American Legion, the Veterans of Foreign Wars, the AMVETS, the Vietnam Veterans, and the Disabled Veterans of America, and others. All of them have programs and policies that they wish to see forwarded. I think it is imperative that anyone who is in public life at least be open-minded and be willing to listen and to try to understand what the desires and needs of these organizations. What are the desires and needs of these organizations? But to know America, you have to be with the people. You have to travel. You have to rub shoulders with all kinds of people in every conceivable circumstance. You have to walk the streets, the highways, the byways. You have to be out from an Indian reservation to the most beautiful country club or hotel. You have to be at schools and picnics. You have to be with labor and farmers. And you have to be with young and old if you're going to know the nation. And surely these requirements are absolutely essential for anyone who seeks to be an effective vice president or a national leader like a president ought to and must be. Norman, just a little piece on this question about the doldrums in Washington when Congress is out and the president is away. Politics, like so many other things, sort of runs in patterns and cycles. When Congress is out of session, this, of course, leaves the Washington press corps with a good deal... Leaves the, this, of course, uh, means that the Washington Press Corps has much less to report on, and therefore they have to spend a good deal of time doing what we call, what journalists call, think pieces. That means that instead of live active news, there's a good deal of commentary, and analysis of what can be, what ought to be, and what may be coming up. One particular instance, one particular development that repeats itself almost with perfect rhythm and accuracy is when the Congress is out and the president may be and the president may not be so busy, that the press all at once focuses in on the vice presidency. And for about a month, generally it's in December, or latter part of November or December, there will be a spate of articles about the vice president, his relationships with the president, about the office of the vice presidency itself, about what a vice president ought to do and what he doesn't do, and even articles about the articles suggesting that the office of the vice presidency should be abolished. You can rely on this better than you can on the weather. It comes with such certainty and with such certainty and regularity that it can well be looked at as one of the assured developments of American political life. How well I recall during my years as vice president that about every November or December there would be a series of articles about President Johnson and Vice President Humphrey. Generally, that the articles would point out that the vice president no longer was attending cabinet meetings, or that the vice president was not invited to the Tuesday lunches, or that the vice president was no longer being consulted on the war in Vietnam, or that the vice president hadn't been at the White House for at least 3 weeks. There was always something taking place, always something being written that would indicate that things were not well between the vice president and the president. But lo and behold, if you're any kind of a student of history, all you need to do is to look back over all other presidents, all other administrations, and you will see that the same thing happened year in and year out. I'm of the opinion that sometimes the journalists just pull out the boilerplate and merely change the names because the scenario is almost identical. But one thing that I always appreciated after these stories was the fact that my relationships with the president would generally improve, in fact would become almost perfect. President Johnson, like other presidents, might very well keep the vice president at arm's length over a certain period of time. There was maybe no reason that the president needed to call on the vice president at all. But when the press started to pick on me as vice president, I could be sure of one development, namely that President Johnson would put his arm around me and shower more attention and affection upon me than at any time. I guess President Johnson used to feel it was perfectly all right for him to be critical of me if he wished to, but for others that was not to be tolerated. And sometimes I almost used to long for a good press attack because it always evoked from President Johnson a special consideration in my behalf. I recall one time, for example, that there were a number of stories that appeared in the press saying that I no longer was being included in the that I was not being included in some of the critical meetings that related to our Vietnam policy. Now the fact is that there were some meetings that from which I was excluded, or put it another way, apparently the president didn't feel that I was needed at these meetings. Whatever the reason, I wasn't there. But the press made a big thing of it. And lo and behold, one day at one of the cabinet meetings, President Johnson took time out to say that Hubert Humphrey was the best vice president that this country had ever had. He praised me profusely and told every member of the cabinet that I was the man that they could work with, and that he expected them to work with me, that I could be trusted, that I had his full faith and confidence. In other words, it was a regular love session. And I used to say to myself, and sometimes to Muriel, how nice it is that the press will take a pot shot at me now and then, because it brings from President Johnson such a quick response of consideration, affection, and of consideration and affection. So you see, politics is really human relations in concentrated form. Presidents and vice presidents are not just public officials, they are people. And their relationships are like those of any others. Sometimes they're better, sometimes not so good. The question is, what should those relationships be? Well, it's very clear that there can only be one president at a time, and that a vice president must, by necessity and by the terms of the Constitution, be a stand-in. He's a substitute in case he's needed. He's to be on the sidelines most of the time. He's not to be front and center. He walks a step or two behind the chief executive, but he needs to be there, and he needs to be there when he's needed, and that means he needs to be prepared in case that he's needed. How well I recall the understanding that President Johnson and I had before the nomination of 1968, when it was clear that I was to be the one that he was to recommend to the Democratic Convention in Atlantic City in 1964. He called me to the White House and had a heart-to-heart talk with me about the vice president. I remember our going into the cabinet room and sitting there with him alone. He looked up at me and said, "How would you like to be the candidate for vice president?" And I said, "I would like it very much. I would like very much to be on the ticket with you." And then President Johnson said, "Well, Hubert, I've got to talk to you about that office, because you and I are good friends. We've worked together in the Congress, and you've been very helpful to me as the majority whip over in the Senate. But I guess you know," he went on to say, "that presidents and vice presidents simply don't hit it off. There's something about the jobs and the responsibilities that seems to get in the way of those friendships and understanding." He reminded me again of how President Truman and Barclay were such close personal friends in the Senate, and yet after about a year, the relationships between these two remarkable men had cooled. He pointed out to me that Franklin Roosevelt had hardly spoken to Harry Truman when Truman was vice president, gave him little or no information about what was going on in the government, and how Dwight Eisenhower had spoken so unkindly of Richard Nixon, and that their relationships were anything but friendly and cordial. And now he said, "I suppose that if we win this election and you become vice president, that we may very well run into the same difficulty. I just want you," he went on to say, "I just want you to know what the possibilities are, because you and I have got to talk this thing out." Then he went on to point out to me that what he wanted of the vice president more than anything else was a deep sense of loyalty, a willingness to work with him, and to, once the decisions were made, to back up those decisions. He said, "This is a marriage for which there is no divorce." He reminded me that there could only be one man that was the leader, that the vice president had to be head by, that the vice, that the office of the vice president simply had to be by its very nature secondary. He told me, he said, I know you are a very active man and you're very gregarious, and yet this office is going to require that you be, that you not be out in front, that you not be in the headlines, but that your energies and efforts be used within the administration in order to help the president and the administration accomplish the agreed upon goals and objectives. In other words, he was telling me in so many words that Hubert Humphrey's style of speaking openly, of being an activist, of being an aggressive political leader, an aggressive public man, that style had to be subdued, and that I had to be brought into harness, so to speak, with the administration. What he was really telling me, what he was really being very fair with me, letting me know what I could expect, and giving me the choice, letting the choice be up to me as to whether or not I wish to submit myself to such discipline and regimen, R-E-G-I-M-E-N. I told the president that I understood this very well, that I was prepared to be the kind of a vice president that he had described, that I was prepared to be loyal, that I would try to confine my activities to consultation and discussion within the administration, that I surely wasn't going to be leading any kind of effort that might be embarrassing or contradictory of administration policy. I said that I thought I could be helpful to him because I had wide contacts in the country and that I thought my relationships with the Congress were rather good. He told me he knew all of this, and that's why he wanted me as his running mate. He said, I think we'll make a great team. But he said, I know there'll be some dark and some difficult days ahead. And there may be times when you wish that you'd never, ever accepted this assignment. I told him that I was prepared for that possibility, but that it was a great honor to be even considered for the office of vice president, and that if we could be elected, that I would be prepared to do whatever was required to fulfill my obligations and responsibilities. It was on that note that we parted. And of course, it was just a day later that President Johnson flew to Atlantic City and recommended me to that convention as the nominee for vice president. Much had transpired, however, before that moment, before that moment of climax at the Atlantic City. All during the winter months of 1964 and the spring, all during the winter and spring months of 1964, there was much speculation as to who would be the nominee for vice president. It was understood that President Johnson would seek office and it would seek the presidency in his own right, having come to the presidency through the death of John Kennedy. So the only major political topic for the commentators, the political analysts and others, was who will be the vice president. And all during those months, from January up to July at the time of the Democratic Convention in Atlantic City, there was much in the press, much talk in the press and in the media about who the person would be that would get the nod from Lyndon Johnson. Well, first of all, there was a great deal of talk about Robert McNamara, because it is a fact that President Johnson thought a great deal of McNamara. He told many people that he thought he was the smartest man he'd ever known and ever met. And even as Vice President of the United States, I heard Lyndon Johnson speak in glowing terms of Bob McNamara. He had a tremendous admiration for him. But of course, Bob McNamara had never been in politics, and it was questionable as to what his politics really was. McNamara did say, however, as the pressure was mounting, that he was a Democrat. But the president had to make it clear that he was not going to was that McNamara was not to be the man. And the way that he did it was rather unique, because immediately there was talk also about Robert Kennedy, and that Robert Kennedy was to be Johnson's running mate. Now, there was no love lost between Robert Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson. This is not to say that Lyndon Johnson didn't respect Robert Kennedy, because he did. He knew that Bob Kennedy was an exceedingly able man, and President Johnson had continued Robert Kennedy in the post of Attorney General after the death of President Kennedy. And it is well known that Robert Kennedy wanted to be the candidate for Vice President. And there was so much talk in the press about it that it finally came to a point where the president himself had to make a decision. He called in Robert Kennedy and told him directly that the president was not going to recommend him for vice president, and that he did not expect, and that he was not going to recommend any cabinet officer for vice president. And that was the announcement that came out. It was a clever ploy on the part of Johnson, even though most of the reporters said what Johnson was doing in making the announcement that none of his cabinet officers would be considered for vice president was simply to pull the rug out from Robert Kennedy, that really no one else was in a position to command the support or to be strong enough to add much to the Johnson ticket. The fact is that President Johnson didn't really need anyone to add much to the ticket. He was at the height of his popularity in 1964. He was doing a good job as president, and people from all walks of life were rallying to him because of the manner in which he was conducting himself and the loyalty which he had demonstrated to the programs and policies of John Kennedy. But the candidacy of Robert Kennedy went down the tube with that of other cabinet members, and including Robert McNamara. Then, of course, the question was, who will be the nominee? From time to time, I was privileged to talk with the president, and he gave me encouragement. In fact, at one time he told me, I believe it was in the month of May, 1964, that if he had his choice, if there was nothing standing in the way, that he would prefer to have me as his running mate over all others that had been mentioned. But he also said to me, of course, there may be other considerations. After all, a president is not always free to make the decision that he alone wants. So on the one hand, he had told me that I was his personal choice. But on the other hand, he indicated there might be political obstacles and political objections. So there I was, hanging between two positions, so to speak. But I decided that the best way for me to conduct myself was to do my job as the majority whip of the Senate, to try my level best to push the programs through the Senate that President Johnson wanted, and to keep in close touch with him, as was my privilege as a member of the Senate leadership. Every Wednesday morning we met for breakfast at the White House, and frequently after those breakfasts, President Johnson would take me aside and talk to me about certain things that he wanted done over in the Senate. Our relationships were friendly, very friendly, and I believe that he looked to me and looked to me to be one of his key leaders in the Congress, and always felt that he could talk very candidly with me, much more so than to some others. He had a great respect for Mike Mansfield, but somehow I doubt that that friendship was fully reciprocated. Senator Mansfield could not help but respect Johnson's leadership, both as a majority leader and as a president. But their personalities were not always compatible, and also President Johnson felt that Senator Mansfield was more or less an isolationist. I'll never forget when he told me one time, He said, you will find that in every Montanan, every man from Montana, there's a little bit of Burton K. Wheeler in them. This was just another way of saying that when you come from Montana, you're bound to be slightly on the isolationist side. And Johnson, of course, was pursuing a vigorous international relations course. Also, he was beginning to edge up to the Vietnam, to greater involvement, greater American participation in Southeast Asia. So in 1964, though, but in 1964, names were coming forth every day. There were names that came forth like Bob Wagner of New York, the former mayor of that great city. There were governors that were talked about, and there was Senator Mansfield himself. In fact, I recall one evening at a banquet in the White House when President Johnson leaned over to me and said, I think I'm going to drop Mike Mansfield's name into the hopper. He'll like it, and it will give a lot of people something to talk about. I could hardly believe my ears, but he said it just that way, and lo and behold, within 2 or 3 days, the name of Senator Mansfield was all over the press. But Mansfield made it clear that he didn't want to be vice president, and so that trial balloon was shot down. And then, of course, the name of my colleague, Senator McCarthy, kept popping up. There isn't any doubt that President and Lady Bird Johnson did have a friendly relationship with Gene and Abigail McCarthy. After all, Gene McCarthy was a very entertaining and erudite man. He had gotten along very well with Johnson in the Senate. And at the time that Lyndon Johnson was nominated for vice president in 1960, it was Gene McCarthy and myself who were the first two Midwestern senators that went to Johnson's suite and told him that he could depend on our support and congratulated him on being nominated for vice president. There were others, of course, like the then governor of Michigan, Soapy Williams, and some of our friends from the ADA who were horror-stricken by the possibility of Johnson being on the ticket with John Kennedy. But this wasn't the case for Gene McCarthy. He was a friend, and he was also a close friend of Robert Kerr, the powerful senator from Oklahoma. And Bob Kerr and Lyndon Johnson were close and intimate friends. So there's no doubt that Gene McCarthy was being given consideration. And his name undoubtedly was being brought up by a number of people in the White House and in the press. So from time to time, that name would be prominently mentioned, as would mine. President Johnson knew that the name of the game for the politics of 64 was the vice presidency. And he played it, and he played that game with gusto and astuteness. Names were floated out and then pulled back. Balloons were sent aloft and then they were pulled down. From time to time, there would be so-called inside stories from the White House that Senator so-and-so was in consideration, even though there wasn't a word of truth to it. And men like Governor Pat Brown of California were mentioned from time to time, as indeed were other Democratic governors. But most every story carried the name of Hubert Humphrey and frequently of Eugene McCarthy. I began to realize, however, that I was being given very serious consideration when one of Lyndon Johnson's closest friends and counselors came to me, and also one of my close friends by the name of James Rowe. Jim Rowe was an attorney in Washington, but in the earlier days he'd been in the Roosevelt administration. He'd worked over in Capitol Hill with Lyndon Johnson, and he was considered to be a trusted friend and counselor to the president. And I recall the night, one evening, that James Rowe came, asked me to come over to his home and have a talk, and I did so. We sat out on his porch, and he said, "I want to talk to you very candidly. I bring a message to you. I want to talk to you very candidly, because you may be considered for the office of vice president." He said, "Now, don't misunderstand me. There's no commitments. The president hasn't made up his mind. But I know there's certain things that he needs to know before he makes up his mind. And this will be true not only of you, but of others." And then he started asking me some questions. What I thought of President Johnson, how I thought he was conducting the presidency, whether or not I had, whether or not my relationships were with him since he had become president were as good as when he was the Senate, as when he was the majority leader. Did I feel that I could be loyal to him? Did I have any basic disagreements with his policies? And then he put the tough questions to me, the personal ones. He said, "Let me be very frank with you. Are there any skeletons in your closet? Is there anything that could come up in case you were nominated that would be scandalous or cause trouble to the administration or to you personally?" "You've got to level with me," said Jim Rowe, "because the president needs to know. Now he'll be asking these, he'll have..." Jim Rowe went on to say that the president will have others asking, will have some other people asking other potential candidates these same questions, so that I shouldn't assume that the nomination was at hand. But these were matters that the president needed to know and on which he needed to have information if he was going to make a proper decision. Well, obviously this meant that I was in serious contention and that the president was giving me serious thought. Later on, Jim Rowe came by and talked to me about, came by one day and again said to me, I want to visit with you once more about this vice presidential matter and your relationships with the president. And he went over many of the same questions that he had discussed with me that evening at his home. And then finally he said to me, "Look, I'm going to call the president, and I want you to tell him that you and I have talked and that you understand completely what I've had to say to you. And if you feel that you are in agreement with some of the concerns that I've expressed on behalf of the president, I wish you'd tell him so." At this point, Jim Rowe picked up the telephone, called the White House, and got the president on the line. And he turned the phone over to me, and I said to the president, "Mr. President, Jim has been here to visit with me this past hour. I know of the concern that you have about the relationship between the president and the vice president. And believe me, I want you to know that I am prepared to fulfill those commitments. You can rely on me. I'll be trustworthy and loyal." And that was about all of the conversation. And the president simply said thank you and said that he was pleased that Jim was there to visit with me and he'd asked him to do so. Again, this was a further indication that things were moving my way, but of course nothing was positive. The name of McCarthy was still being mentioned, the name of Pat Brown of California was being mentioned, and there were others. And the press was continuing to speculate as to just what Johnson would do. And the president was playing the thing for all it was worth, because the only political issue at the time was who would be the vice presidential nominee. The Democratic convention would make that decision, but only after the president had made his recommendation. That was a foregone conclusion. Well, as we approached the convention, the news stories were coming fast and furious, and it appeared that it was between McCarthy and myself. When we got to the convention, both Eugene McCarthy and I were asked to appear on Meet the Press. We did so. I think I did well in that performance, but it was still not clear what President Johnson was going to do. Then Jim Rowe appeared, and he got in touch with me and said, I want you to stay close by. And he told me in so many words that it looks like the president's going to select you, and that he's going to tell McCarthy that Gene is not in the picture. That he or one of his people is going to tell McCarthy that he, Gene, is not in the picture. So he said, stand by. I don't know what will happen. He said, I can't predict what Johnson's going to do for sure. But from what I gather in my talks with him, it appears that you're the man. Well, I felt now that I surely was the man, but I also knew that the president was perfectly capable of changing his mind. And then I knew, too, that he wanted to keep the speculation wide open, because it was the only way to keep that convention lively and interesting. Other than that, there was very little to talk about at the convention, since the president's nomination was a foregone conclusion, and there was very little struggle over platform. There was some issue over credentials that related to the delegation from Mississippi. But other than that, was very little to do. It was at this point that the president called upon me, however, to try to be of help on the Mississippi credentials fight. There was a Freedom Party in Mississippi that was contesting with the regular delegation, and he called upon me to try to solve it because it was disrupting the convention. This was another one of the civil rights issues. He asked me to bring in some extra help, and I readily did. I asked my good friend from Minnesota, the then Attorney General of our state, Walter Mondale, to come in and try to be of assistance with me. At that point, the president had contacted Walter Reuther and sent Walter Reuther to the Democratic National Convention. And Walter, myself, and Mondale sat down and worked out a compromise that seated both the regular delegation from Mississippi and the new Freedom Party delegation. It was a compromise that didn't seem to please anybody, but at least it held the convention together. But it was a message for the future, because in the 4 years later, the convention was to be confronted even with more serious credential battles than this one. And in those 4 years, the struggle was to be waged in the South between some of the so-called party regulars and the party reformers. And surely this was the case in Mississippi. But at that point, I was being tested once again by Lyndon Johnson. Was I capable of handling a difficult matter? Could I be trusted? Could I be relied upon? I gather that my performance pleased him, because Jim Rowe asked me now to be sure to be close at hand, that there may be a call any minute from the White House. Well, the call came, and the next thing I know, Jim Rowe was over to see me at my hotel room and said, prepare, I want you to prepare to go to the White House at once. There'll be a private plane, but you're going to be accompanied by Senator Tom Dodd of Connecticut. I said, why? I said, is Tom being considered? He said, no. He said, this is just a cover, so don't be concerned about it. You're the one that's being considered, and the president wants to talk to you. But Tom Dodd is going to go along. This will keep the press off balance, and it'll give a good deal of speculation and to what's going to happen, and that's what the president wants. So I took him at his word, and I went to the plane, where I was met by Senator Thomas Dodd of Connecticut, and we flew to Washington in that two-engine Beechcraft. When we arrived there, we were picked up by the presidential limousine, presidential limousine. Jack Valenti was in the car, and he explained to us that the president wasn't quite ready yet to receive us. Why, we didn't know. We were told that the president was in some meetings, but I gather what was happening is that the White House was summoning the press corps and getting them ready to speculate even further on what was happening in the vice presidential contest. When we finally arrived at the White House, about a half hour or so after our landing at the airport, an aide came out. We came in the southwest gate. The big limousine was parked by the back entrance of the south entrance of the White House, and an aide came forth and summoned Senator Dodd first. Well, Now surely some decision was to be made. I had to rely upon the good word of Jim Rowe. He had told me that Tom Dodd's presence was not significant, that I had nothing to be concerned about. Nevertheless, Dodd was in with the president for better than a half hour. At first I was very concerned, and then because I was dog tired, because I was exhausted and fatigued from the convention, I fell asleep in the back seat of the limousine. A little bit later, there was a knock at the door opened, and someone touched my shoulder and said, "Senator Humphrey, the president wants to see you." I pulled myself together and went into the White House. I was escorted to the president's waiting room, what was known at the time as the fish room. And a little later, the president came by and said, "Hubert, let's go into the cabinet room. I want to talk to you." And it was there that we had that heart-to-heart talk. After that visit, I was told by the president to keep this conversation confidential. He said to me, "You're the man that I would like to have as my running mate in light of our discussion." He said, "Let's call Muriel and fill her in." Well, Muriel was at Atlantic City in our hotel room. The president picked up the telephone and the call was put through and Muriel was on the line. The president said to her, "Muriel, how would you like to have your husband be the vice presidential nominee? Then he went on to say, "We're going to nominate your boy." I don't quite know what Muriel's response was, but apparently it was in the affirmative. At that point, the president said, "Now you tell Muriel what's happened here. And I got on the phone and told her, "Well, I guess you've already received the message, and there isn't much more I can add right now, except to tell you that the president and I have had a very good talk, and I'm pleased and excited about it." With that, I told her that I would be returning to Atlantic City at once and would come to see her and tell her more of my conversation with the president. I got back in the car with Senator Dodd, and we both went back up to Atlantic City. And now the media was really on the story. They apparently, obviously they knew of the meeting at the White House, and there was speculation that possibly it was going to be Tom Dodd, that McCarthy had been dropped. And was it going to be Humphrey? There were those that said, "Surely it's going to be Humphrey, that Dodd doesn't have a chance." But then there were those that pointed out that Dodd was a Catholic, that he was from the New England state, and that he had worked closely with Johnson in the Senate, and that this would be a natural combination, and that Humphrey could add very little that Dodd couldn't bring to the ticket. And after all, Johnson didn't really need someone from the Midwest, because Johnson's record for agriculture was good enough to please any farmer. What he really needed was somebody from the New England states, somebody from the Irish, and from the Irish, someone from the Irish voters, because those were the ones that were the Kennedy people, and Johnson needed the Kennedy people, and so the story went. Well, at that. Well, about that time, I was in my hotel room, and many of my Minnesota friends were gathered around me. And the question came up again from the press, including some of our local press: "Senator Humphrey, where have you been? We understand you've been to the White House. What did the president say? Are you going to be the vice presidential nominee?" And all I could say was, "Well, you will have to wait and hear about that from the president." At about this time, there was a telephone. About this time, one of the WCCO radio and TV reporters from Minneapolis had a call from WCCO. Period. The call from the radio station was to inform the local reporter in Atlantic City that a news bulletin had just come from the White House, and that they were broadcasting it. And at this point, Jim Borman, the WCCO radio reporter at the convention, said to me, put your ear to a telephone here, to a telephone receiver, and hear what WCCO has to say. And the bulletin came over the WCCO radio that from the White House, it had been announced that the president was coming to Atlantic City and was going to nominate Hubert Humphrey for the office of vice president. So I really got my first public notice of my impending nomination through the local radio station in Minneapolis, WCCO. It was an exciting moment for all of us. And of course, there was great joy, there was great excitement and jubilation in our room when that report was circulated. And indeed, the president arrived shortly thereafter, and that evening made his acceptance speech, and then nominated me, and then asked the convention to place my name in nomination. Then asked the convention to nominate me for the office of vice president. He poured forth his praise. He poured forth his praise upon me, and he was lavish in his praise and his commendation. He said above all that he was asking me to be the nominee for vice president because he wanted someone who had the qualifications, if need be, to fulfill the heavy burdens and responsibilities of the president. He told the convention of his personal friendship for me and that he knew that I could be a great help to him in carrying out the responsibilities of his office and administration. It was indeed a moment of glory and honor for me, an exciting moment in my life. I couldn't help but think at that particular moment how far we had come from the days of a boy in South Dakota in a small town, through pharmacy school and the University of Minnesota, into graduate school at Louisiana, and then into Minneapolis working with the WPA and teaching at McAllister College, then mayor of Minneapolis and United States Senator, and all of the hard work and effort that we'd put in through those many years in public life. It all flashed through my mind in an instant, and here I was to be nominated as the candidate for vice president. It was almost too much, and in all candor, I was overwhelmed with the thought of it. My eyes were filled with tears, not of sorrow, but of joy. My whole body was teeming with the excitement that was there and that was mine. My family was with me. Muriel brought all the children to the convention, and they were there in the box at the convention listening to the president. Responding to the excitement of the hour, it surely was a great evening for the Humphreys, and one that we'll always remember, and one for which we'll be everlastingly grateful. To be Vice President of the United States to me was indeed a singular honor, second only to being President. And I knew that this was a great moment in my life, and I wanted to be worthy of it. The next day I was called upon to give the acceptance speech. I worked hard on that speech. In fact, I'd worked most of the night after the president's talk and all of the next day trying to put together a good speech. I had the help of several very good people who pitched in and gave me some suggestions. But the important thing was to make a speech that would lift that convention, because the convention had more or less been a routine one, with the exception of the president's speech of acceptance and his suggestion that I be the nominee for vice president. There had not been too much controversy, and too much news. So I deceived, knowing that the Republicans had nominated Barry Goldwater for the office of president, I decided to seize on the theme of that would bring Barry Goldwater into comparison with the Democratic Party and indeed with the nation. And the theme went something like this. Most Americans, Democrats and Republicans alike, favor federal aid to education, but not Barry Goldwater. Most Americans, Republicans and Democrats alike, support federal assistance to housing for our people, but not Barry Goldwater. I took one issue after another and identified support for it with most Americans, including Republicans and Democrats alike, but not Barry Goldwater. And I developed a litany of these statements, and a rhythm soon was perceptible. And the great audience, the great convention audience, started to join in. And after a few statements, there was thunderous response on the part of the audience. They would join in at that phrase, but not Barry Goldwater. And then, breaking out in tumultuous applause and laughter, it was indeed a moment of high spirit. And the tone of the campaign was set right then and there. From that moment on, I was to be the campaigner, the cutting edge of the 1964 election, a Democratic campaign effort. President Johnson confined himself to the White House, taking care of the business of the nation and reserving his efforts for a few well-placed statements and finally a series of speeches in key metropolitan areas. From the period of August up to November, I was on the road, traveling from state to state, going every place to take the message of our party and of the Johnson administration. It was my job to be what they called then the happy warrior, and to make that campaign an exciting one. I did my level best. I remember that we had a four-engined Electra aeroplane, and it was my first experience to have a private plane to carry us from city to city. And we carried out a very demanding and extensive schedule, making several meetings a day. And every place that we went, it was perfectly obvious that the Johnson-Humphrey ticket was receiving wide and popular support. President Johnson was on the telephone, using that instrument that was so much a part of his life, lining up favorable editorial comment, raising money for the campaign, and gaining support from the most unlikely sources. Republicans of national reputation were coming out openly for President Johnson. Business people that ordinarily would never come close to a Democratic candidate were signing up for President Johnson. They were contributing to his campaign and they were making statements in his behalf. The Goldwater campaign was not getting off the ground, and the Democratic campaign was flying high, and I was in the midst of it. No, frankly, I loved the campaign, and the 1964 campaign was a thrilling experience. Every evening, I would call the president and give him a report, telling him how we were doing, what the public reaction was, and I would get his counsel and his advice. There were people in Washington that were preparing statements and speeches and getting them out to us so that we could lay out a well-organized campaign effort and a consistent political philosophy. I believe it was one of the better campaigns, if not the best, that I've ever been in all of my life. There was a group at the White House that called itself the 5 o'clock group. These were some of President Johnson's campaign advisors who would meet every day at 5 o'clock and analyze what had been going on and preparing responses to the Goldwater and Miller messages. It was Bill Miller of New York, congressman from New York, who was the Republican vice presidential nominee. And that 5 o'clock group would also see to it that messages and statements and speeches got to me, because again, I was to be the main spokesman in this campaign until the final days when the president would hit the trail.